Good morning. Are we on? Yes. We're on. How lovely to be here. I've been away a bit lately, so it feels really good to be back with my home community. And today I want to talk about joyful mind, kind mind, and great mind. Joyful mind, kind mind, and great mind. You already have them. Cool. But we can cultivate them as well. And these terms come from the end of Dogen's Instructions to the Cook. Dogen being the founder of our Soto school. So Dogen wrote a lot of work, a big old thing called the Shobo Genzo. And I remember the first time I heard Dogen, I had just gotten into Zen, and I was on a tour, and I was driving my car, and I'd gotten a recording of Gary Snyder reading Dogen's Mountains and Water Sutra, which is what Tim's been talking about. And I was like really excited. Oh, I've heard about Dogen, and I'm into this Zen, and I put it on, and I listened to like 37 seconds, and I just went, this is gobbledygook. I took it out. It was just like, this is so weird. So Dogen's teaching is beautiful and it's powerful, but it's complex. It's very poetic. It combines poetry and philosophy, both of which can be hard to access. So for most people, to begin to appreciate Dogen takes doing it together with other people, with a teacher. So I don't actually recommend, if you haven't tried it, just go home and buy the Shobo Genzo and start reading. I mean, you might get into it, but most people are like, what just happened? So we'll try and find an entrance point here. So Dogen has many different kinds of works, but the Instructions to the Cook is often considered his most practical text because it is where he talks about the head cook for the temple who's doing, you know, other people are sitting in there doing zazen, and the cook is like measuring rice, cooking rice, buying rice, planning how much rice to buy, going to the market. So he's talking to the people who are doing some of the most practical work of the temple. Now, Dogen, he had studied for many years in China. He talks about several people that he met in his life as being profoundly inspirational, influential. His first teacher, a Tendai teacher whose name I forget. His first Rinzai teacher whose name I forget. And then he goes to China and he meets two Tenzos and his Zen teacher, Ru Jing. And the Tenzos blow his mind. These are the people who really, you can see that his meeting of them shifts his whole perspective on what Zen is. From being some kind of philosophical activity or one that's all about this sort of transformation of the self in the process of Zazen exclusively, to one that's about doing things in the world to support all beings, doing practical things, measuring rice, cooking rice, planning how much rice to buy, going to the market to buy the rice. So, feeding the Sangha. This is what the Tenzo does. Feeds the community. So the instructions to the cook are specifically directed towards the person who is the head cook at the temple. But as is generally the case, Dogen's work, you can see how it usually has a specific thing, like he talks about mountains and waters. And he is talking about mountains and waters, like actual mountains and waters. But he's talking about them also as a symbolic or metaphorical representation. Likewise, with his instructions to the cook, although they're very, very specific to the person cooking the temple, they are also clearly intended to be specific instructions for anyone who is doing anything. So if you're doing something, the instructions of the cook are intended to be practical instructions on how to do that, if you want to do it for the liberation of all beings forever. If you haven't figured out that you want to do that, just stick around. Maybe you'll get some inspiration. It's a fun reason to do things. For the liberation of all things, all beings forever. It's joyful. It's joyful. So In this text, he refers to joyful mind, kind mind, and great mind. And he has, there's a long, the text, the this particular fascicle of his thing is about 14 pages long, and it has all kinds of cool stuff. I'm just, the very end, he talks about these three qualities of mind. And whenever I was a Tenzo, and I was getting real downhearted, and I was like, I'm standing in this hot kitchen, and everyone else gets to practice Zazen for hours and hours all day, which I would complain about on another occasion. And I have to stand here in the kitchen and just cook and cook and cook, you know, because you cook for 35 people every meal for a week. You spend a lot of time in the kitchen. And if I got a little downhearted, I'd just go down in the basement and I get out the last section of this and get a little inspiration. So anyway, he says, joyful mind is the mind that rejoices. Well, simple. Kind mind is parental mind. Great mind is a mind like a great mountain or a great ocean. Huh. Mountains and waters, for those of you who've been around the last few weeks. So I'm going to start by talking about joyful mind. I will read the passage in a minute. But I'm going to prepare you because Dogen's talks quite a bit in this little section about living in different realms, but how we should be joyful because we have a human body and can practice in a human way. And he says, and you know, if you were born in a God body, then you might not be able to practice because you'd be like, everything is awesome. Why would I practice? Because if you're like me, you came to practice because there's suffering. And this is intended to be the ultimate and constant motivation of our practice. There's suffering in the world, and you can do something about it. So he says, if you were born as a god, you might be, I have everything I want, I feel good, why would I practice? And if you were born in hell, your suffering would be so tremendous that you may not even have the capacity to access a will to do something about the suffering. And this is very standard Buddhist doctrine. Now, I think it is good whenever bringing up the different realms of existence, the animal realm, the hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, the human realm, the titan realm, and the god realm, to say that most Buddhists throughout history and most Buddhists in the world think these are real things, and if when you die, you will be reborn in one of them. And that will happen for a really long time, like kajillions and kajillions of eons, until you realize enlightenment. So that's just good to just be like, all right, that's the deal. However, like someone like me and many of my peers and probably a lot of people in this room think of these as symbolic representations of God realm is when we just think everything's fine, so we're not motivated to do anything very helpful for anyone. Hell realm represents when we're suffering so much we can't even motivate ourselves to practice. Like one of my students came to me and said, you know, I was so depressed, I couldn't actually even get out of bed, let alone sit zazen. One of the most interesting things, though, is actually both these ways of looking at it are well supported by Buddhist doctrine. And I was actually at a retreat with some Tibetan teachers last week, and someone asked this Tibetan guy, you know, what about these realms? You know, are they really existing? And he's like, no, they're all just projections of mind. So he's just quoting Yogacara-style Buddhist teachings that everything you experience is just the way your mind has experienced things. So if you feel like you're in hell, it's not like a really existing place that you can go to. It's just that's your experience. You feel like that. If you feel like you're in the human realm, maybe you have a little motivation to practice. That's just how you feel. It's not like you went somewhere else. Then the next day, someone asked the same question. He said, no, these are really existing realms. So, it's cool. it's cool. So I'm going to read this whole section here on joyful mind. My eyes are changing. Impermanence. You know what's impermanent is my ability to discern you as people right now. My glasses are off if you're listening to this on the internet. In performing your duties along with the others officer with the other officers and staff, you should maintain joyful mind, kind mind, and great mind. Joyful mind is the mind that rejoices. You should think, if I were born in the realm of gods, I would be attached to pleasure and would not arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, nor have the opportunity to practice. Then how could I cook food to offer to the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? The most excellent of all things are the three treasures. Even Indra's virtue cannot compare to them, nor can that of a wheel-turning king. The regulations for Zen monastery states, respected in the world, quiet and secluded from daily affairs, pure and unconditioned, these qualities belong most of all to the community of monks. We are fortunate to be born in the human realm, and even beyond this, we have the good fortune of cooking meals to be offered to the three treasures. If this is not a great karmic relationship, is this not a great karmic relationship? We should be most grateful for this. You should also think, if I were born in hell, in the realm of hungry ghosts, beasts, or demons, or if I were born in the eight terrible situations, I could not with my own hands cook pure meals to offer to the three treasures, even if I were to use a monk's miraculous power. This is so because it would be my destiny to be a vessel of suffering, with body and mind bound up. But since you are cooking pure meals in this lifetime, this is a life of rejoicing and a body of rejoicing. It is a wholesome cause from limitless eons. It is merit that does not erode. I hope you will do your work and cook this meal this very day, at this very moment, with this body, the fruit of myriad births and thousands of lifetimes, thereby creating merit for myriad beings. To penetrate this is joyful mind. Even if you become a wheel-turning king, there will be no merit if the meal you cook is not an offering to the three treasures. Your effort will be like bubbles or vanishing flames. Whoa. So, three treasures, in case you don't know, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Teacher, teaching, community. The joy of serving. So, what really stands out to me here is that the joy is that you get to work. You have the opportunity to work. Normally, I like joy that's kind of like, I got a sandwich. You know, or my stepdaughter made dinner. Joy! Which is joyful. I mean, that's wonderful that we get things that we want. It's wonderful. It's good to appreciate it. But ultimately, Buddhism teaches that it is a trap. As long as you're waiting to get things for yourself, you will always be creating the conditions to be unsatisfied. And we will do this for a long time. So we don't want to freak out about it, but just be aware that the tendency to be acquisitive is the root of our problem, acquisitive and aversive. So the joy that he's encouraging is a joy that you can do something. Simple things, like, as he talks about earlier in the text, measuring rice, deciding which shelf to put the pots on, deciding how much food you're going to have to make. I was talking to my friend. I was in Milwaukee 2 weeks ago, and my friend Rayrin, the guiding teacher there, she is at Milwaukee Zen Center. She was the Tenzo at Green Gulch Farm for 2 years, and she said every meal you had to calculate a new head count, anything from like 40 to 200 people that would vary throughout the day to plan the meals. Wow, that's using your noggin. So if you're like, oh, I'm at my job as an accountant, I can't do practice here. All practice can be done for the liberation of all beings. What does Buddha mean? It means someone who committed himself to freeing everybody. What's the Dharma? It's a tool for freeing everybody. What's the Sangha? Some people are committed to freeing people. So that is a little, you may be a little puzzled. You're like, well, if I'm sitting at this job calculating someone's tax deductions, how can that be for the liberation of all people? This is a fundamental koan of Soto Zen. If you're not already exploring it, begin. Begin. And maybe invest your lifetime in just that question. How can this be bodhisattva activity? How can this be bodhisattva activity? So, when we do these activities joyfully, when we call to go, oh, wow, I could do this, you know, the idea is to direct them towards something beneficial. So, you know, if you're just like, sweet, I got a case of beer and I'm getting toasted. No. No. That's not what we're talking about, right? So you'd be like, well, that's wholehearted activity. The object of the activity is important. That it is activity is important. That the reason you're doing it is important, and what the offering is for. That it is an offering and it's for something beneficial. And then to let in this quality of joyful mind, like, wow, I'm mowing the lawn for MCMC. I don't know who's mowing the lawn these days, but bows to you. Thank you. People do all kinds of stuff everywhere, like beautiful flowers. And someone put in the air conditioner. Thank goodness. Simple, wholehearted activity for the Sangha. So, you know, the thing is, once we recognize that, one, we can do something right now, which is always true. Always true. Even when you're asleep, actually. That's why you should hang out with more Tibetans. And when you're asleep, you could wake up in your dream and be like, wow, I'm dreaming. How can I liberate beings here? That's hard to do, so we're not going to focus on that. But we're dreaming now. What we experience right now is not reality. It's a construction of our habits of mind. And within it, we can have a little wakefulness. I can do something. I can make that an offering to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to liberation for everyone. And I can do it with joy. Once I do that, can I just infuse it with joy? Wow. Then this happens naturally, but he's saying cultivate it actively. Oh, wow. Wow. So the only problem with cultivating joy is then you decide, like, I'm supposed to be joyful, and then if you feel bad, you're like, oh, I guess I'm a bad Buddhist. Yes, bad Buddhist. So that's not very helpful. So, you know, you want to acknowledge the reality of how you feel, but we can keep bringing in this cognitive message that this offering of our life to liberation is an activity of joy, of rejoicing. You know, these days, it's not as bad right now. I feel like, remember last year, like, everyone was kind of tripping out around here, frankly. They're like, oh my God, like, white supremacists openly marching in the streets of the United States. You know, and people freaking out now. Children being separated from their parents. People say, oh, you're being political. I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about human beings who suffer. So I talked to a Jewish person who was in a synagogue when there are white nationalists in Charlottesville, Virginia, outside of her synagogue, screaming about how they would get rid of all the Jews from the United States. That's a painful, terrifying place to be. And some of those white nationalists were armed. So, you know, people are like, oh, this is a bad time. No rejoicing. And, you know, we have to, you know, if you have strong feelings, it's important to take care of them and be present to them, which is one of the principal things that I teach. But at the same time, we can rejoice. You're alive. You can actually do something about this. You know, oh, I can't do anything about it. It's never true. Certainly, within the context of Buddhist thought, it can't be true. The fundamental tenet of Buddhism is that every single second you can do something liberative. And you can go, wow, all right, I don't know what it's going to be. And I will say that it doesn't mean, if you look at then the next few tenets of Buddhism, it isn't like, quick, run around and scream. rejoice while you do it. No. No. The liberative work we do is of offering our effort to people, which includes effort of investigating our own feelings, our own thoughts, connecting with people, identifying ways with our cognitive capacities to do something that holds people up and supports them. We can rejoice in this. You can remind yourself. It's a place of rejoicing. So let's rejoice together. You know, you probably wish that you were at some kind of church where we sing, I have a really good song. You know, the organ would start to come in. Oh, well. Zen. So we're going to be really quiet. We're really good at quiet rejoicing. If you come in here on the sixth day of Rohatsu, of course, some people are like feeling like their legs are going to fall off. But there's all these people who look so quiet, and yet when they open their mouths, it's just rejoicing. Quiet rejoicing. So I invite you to find a posture that is conducive to meditation. And I will allow us to do a little contemplative meditation, we call it here. We're going to actually we're going to sit in meditation and think. Whoa! Who knew you could do that in a Zen center? So first, I invite you to just begin to notice the physical sensations in your body and the sensory awarenesses, so like your ability to see and hear. And as you do this, see if you can find a little joy in that. That is kind of incredible that it's even happening. You take it for granted, but it's actually wonderful and amazing. You offering your awareness in a joyful way. This is liberative. You can just feel this, like on an emotional level, if that's what's right for you, or you can just be attuned to the senses and the body with the joyful quality that you invite, or you can just think about it with your thinky part. And now let's just shift and think about things that we are able to do that are beneficial in the biggest possible picture, that really contribute to wellness for everything. And see if you can think about these things that you can do in a joyful way. Just think, oh, isn't it amazing? You know, you get, oh, wow, wonderful that I can be present to the people in my family, or whatever it is, your way of making the offering will be particular. Just think about ways, not as obligations, but as joys, as a cause for rejoicing. And if there's no joy there, that's okay. Just be present to that. Let's just release that meditative engagement. Joyful mind. Kind mind is parental mind. Just as parents care for their children, you should bear in mind the three treasures. Even poor or suffering people raise their children with deep love. Their hearts cannot be understood by others. This can only be known when you have become a father or a mother. They do not care whether they themselves are poor or rich. Their only concern is that their children will grow up. They pay no attention to whether they themselves are cold or hot, but cover their children to protect them from the cold or shield them from the hot sun. This is extreme kindness. Only those who have aroused this mind can know it, and only those who practice this mind can understand it. Therefore, you should look after water and grain, as a cook, with compassionate care as though tending your own children. The great master Shakyamuni Buddha gave the final 20 years of his life to protect us in the age of the decline of learning. What was his intention? He offered his parental mind to us without expecting any result or gain. So the practice of tapping or referring to parental love as a means for understanding the human capacity for enormous compassion is old and runs as a strain throughout Buddhist literature. Many of you come here on Saturdays and chant, just as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world. So this capacity that one can see in parents is kind of amazing. I just like to remember that basically, if it weren't for an absolutely staggering amount of effort in the first few years of our life, no one here would be alive. When you watch a wildebeest be born, they're like, the mother gives birth and the wildebeest falls down and then it stands up. Wow, human beings are really, really not like that. You know, we're basically marsupials without a pouch. So even if you're like, yeah, my parents sucked, some people think, maybe you weren't raised by your parents. Maybe you had a very traumatic childhood. But even with that horror of trauma, not necessarily being raised by people who aren't your parents can be quite wonderful, but even if there's an enormous amount of pain and suffering and difficulty there, you really wouldn't be alive without a huge amount of love and care. It just doesn't happen. And then, of course, there's this general, we feel, a lot of people feel a particular kind of sense with their family. This is what in the Tibetan tradition they call compassion with attachment. Passion and attachment. So then, on the other hand, you might be like, some people kind of get irritated. They're like, I'm not a parent. He says, like, you can't experience this if you're not a parent. Yeah, I get that. That's cool. Dogen wasn't a parent. None of the people he was writing to were parents. And he was basically an orphan. Both of his parents were dead by the time he was 8. And I think one of them had died when he was really wee. I may have the ages off. So this comes more from, he observed people. He saw something that a lot of people do, not everyone does. And he thought, this is a good way for us to understand what this is. The enormous sacrifice of people just getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, feed the baby. Very few people are like, screw it, baby will be fine. That's pretty rare. It's pretty rare because people just do it. They just do it. This is an inherent natural capacity that people have to love and care and take care of. Everybody. We can tap it. And then the idea is to realize it for everything. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Of course, being a parent, I can say, my love for my children is massively mingled with all kinds of horrible neurotic tendencies of codependence, anxiety, control, anger. Wow. So this is where Dogen is idealizing because he didn't even have to deal with his parents. That makes it easy. So for the rest of us, we realize there's all this other stuff mixed in, and that's okay, but to look at that, the part that is least attached. At the end, he says, what did Shakyamuni do? He gave us this loving energy with, I'll just read it. I don't remember it. He offered his parental mind without expecting any result or gain. So even if with our children or with whatever object of parental mind we're using, we are not like trying to, you know, I'll be happy with whatever my child does. And oftentimes we have a personal, we're trying to get our this thing we love to be a certain way so we can feel okay. This is a massive motivation of behavior. People who are like really, really compassionate, this is also called codependence in an extreme form. But when you're like, oh, I'm going to do this kind thing because then I will be good enough. Or then the situation will be fixed so I don't have to feel uncomfortable anymore. Or all these things. These are fine. These are an absolutely inherent part of being human that we should investigate with mindfulness and be loving and present to. But the idea is there's something deeper and beyond that, where that offering of love and care is just purely an offering. Purely an offering. Or you're never going to... If you're saying to your child, I gave so much to you and expected nothing in return, and you're lying, right? But if you can really say, I gave so much to you and I expect nothing in return, that's possible. Both these things happen. So we're cultivating that second one of just really giving it all away. That's joyful. It's painful to be stuck in always trying to get things okay for ourselves. We think it's going to work, but it does not. So let's practice cultivating kind mind. So I will again invite you to find a posture that's conducive to meditation. Do you think we should turn the air conditioning back on? Would you guys die if we did that?
My polar bear says yes.
Oh, polar bear says yes. All right. So always listen to the polar bear. It's a tattoo, by the way. So just find a posture that's good for you to focus awareness, develop qualities of mind. It's good for these kind of practices to close the eyes. And let's just, this will be a very thinky kind of meditation, but some people access things more through their heart, which is the feeling. Some people more through words, and other people may be visualizing. So whatever one of these modes is more natural to you is all fine. But just begin to think about how you could express this kind mind, this mind that just loves and cares for people. And it could be with a, you know, something simple like a pet, but it could also be with like some, you know, like, oh, the planet that's getting warmer. How could I manifest my love for all the beings that live on this sphere together? Whatever. Just think of ways that you can manifest a love without attachment, kind mind. And let's just release this practice. Let the senses rest here in this space. The mind quiet from the start, the heart can remain open. And you can open the eyes. Joyful mind, kind mind, great mind. Great mind could also just be called like how things are. This, whatever this is, great mind. It may seem a little weird way to put it, but when we refer to things in Buddhism, we refer to them as they are experienced. As they are experienced, not as something external to our experience. So finally, or primarily, everything is mind. And mind is great. Great mind is like a great mountain or a great ocean. It does not have any partiality or exclusivity. You should not regard a pound as light or a ton as heavy. Do not be attracted by the sounds of spring or take pleasure in seeing a spring garden. When you see autumn colors, do not be partial to them. You should allow the four seasons to advance in one viewing. Us Minnesotans, take note. See an ounce and a pound with an equal eye. In this way, you should study and understand the meaning of great. If the Tenzo of Montjia had not studied the word great, he would not have awakened Senior Fu by laughing at him. If Zen Master Guishan had not understood the word great, he would not have blown the unlit fire three times. If Priest Dongshan had not known the word great, he would not have taught a monk by saying, Buddha is 3 pounds of hemp. You should know that these great masters all studied the word great over hundreds of matters. Thus they brought forth the great shout of freedom, expounded the great principle, penetrated the great question, trained a great student, and in this way completed the single great matter. The abbot, officers, staff, and other monks should never forget about these three kinds of mind. I'm not going to say you should never forget, but you don't have to. You could remember them. You could remember them. So he cites a bunch of koans here, and that's like each one. You could do a Dharma talk on just the one koan. He says he starts out by saying you should not see a pound as light or a ton as heavy. A pound as light or a ton as heavy. So generally speaking, the human mind experiences everything as relative to other things. So we think that's down and that's up. And we don't actually know this as a thing without its downness. Without its downness. So then you like get families and you have various siblings, and it's like the older sibling is kind of the crotchety but smart one. And the middle one is the, you know, kind of peacemaker but kind of unmotivated one. And the third one is the wild one. You see this? I'm just making those up. There's probably some like specific pattern. But families make this, right? And then, so that's relative. People are given relative value and then they live them. They either enact them, they make their life out of that relative value they're assigned, or maybe they rebel against them, and so they get all kinds of weird habits that are in relation. But finally, that placing of a relative value onto something makes it into something. It limits it. Limits it. So Nagarjuna, the great master, this section is really on emptiness. He says, all dependent things are without characteristic. So characteristic is any relative quality assigned to something. It was heavy or light, right? Bright or dark. So, of course, these are useful. It's, you know, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'll grab the one-ton bag of rice and carry it inside myself. I'll get help. And if it's a one-pound bag, I'll pick it up. But we're not, like, abandoning that. You won't, no matter how much anyone talks about the fact that characteristic is empty. But if you begin to be able to see and remember that characteristics are empty, they're just relative values that you are assigning, what you will see is they always limit things. What emptiness is about is possibility. Once you see beyond the ascribed characteristic, every single phenomena is infinitely laden with possibility. This is why liberation is possible. So you can free the people in your family from the preconceptions. You can free the people in our community from preconceptions that are, I'm good, they're bad. I'm bad, they're good. I'm smart, they're stupid. Don't do this. Don't do this. Then it gets in a part, I was like, oh, I don't like it. Do not take pleasure in spring. I'm like, but I want to take pleasure in spring. Dogen, what is that? So, take joy that you can do something liberative in spring. What can that liberative act be? Being present to spring is liberative. But grabbing it, taking pleasure. Oh, now I have spring. And then you will have winter. You don't have to have either one. They have you. You can be free within it. Instead of experiencing something beautiful as an acquisition or something to hold, you can see your presence with it as your offering and make that a joyful act. And then when you don't like it, they're like, I have to cook a ton of rice. You know, you're like, oh my God, I have to cook food for 87,000 people. I'm at work, it's Monday, and I'm behind. My family. You can receive that and be like, oh, I can be aware. Wow. Joy. I can be kind. Possibility of doing something warm. Great mind. Whatever I think about this is not true. And yet, it manifests just in what we're doing. That's why he says, Dongshan, a monk asked Dongshan, famous koan, Dongshan, who's one of the people whose name, this is really complicated how this happened, but he's one of the original people. We end up with the word Soto Zen, and To is the beginning of his name, and well, whatever. Anyway, Dongshan's like our grandpappy. And a monk asked Dongshan, what is Buddha? Dongshan said, 3 pounds of hemp, sometimes translated 3 pounds of flax. Now, no one really knows what this means, but what you can see is he's talking about something very specific that is described in relative terms. So this is why people turn off, they get the tape of Dogen and then they turn it off. Because it's kind of confusing. He says, don't view it in relative terms, and yet it's only all this, this greatness, this characteristiclessness, this possibility-ness is always revealed just in specifics of the present moment. He's not talking about some other land you'll go to or some way of seeing things that you don't have. It's actually how things are. Just in that moment of saying, I've got 3 pounds of hemp, I got to grind this to make the food. He didn't say, I've got to grind this. I added that. He just says, this. Just this thing. This is my opportunity to view my relationship to this with kindness, realize that my ability to relate to it is joyful, and then see it as possibility with great mind. So great mind is the principal thing that we practice here at a Soto Zen place, because great mind is Zazen mind. Zazen mind, sometimes we focus on the breath in the body, but Zazen can also just be just being. So I would like to end this talk with just a couple minutes of just being. So I invite you to find a really good just being posture. Weirdly, we choose a particular just being in Zazen posture. It's good though. And here, it's good to sit with the eyes open, with the body strong and relaxed. And just let your awareness rest in everything that is happening. You can be aware of physical sensation. You can be aware of sound. You can be aware of thoughts, if there are thoughts. Oh, be aware that they're happening. Feelings. offer them awareness. And if you think, oh no, I'm not aware, you're wrong, because you must be, because you just said that. Thank you all very much.